Good afternoon and welcome to this week's edition of Every Woman, coming to you live from Studio A at the world headquarters of KKFI here in Midtown, Kansas City. I am one of the hosts today, Rachel, and your faithful board operator. Joining me, as is her wont, via Zoom is Fiona, one of the producers and my co-host today. Hi, Fiona.
Rachel, it's good to see you and everyone else to hear you.
It looks very sunny where you are. You're very dramatically backlit. I'm a little jealous.
It's kind of gray outside, and there's like one patch of sunlight that's just catching the window and turning it pure white and catching my hair and thankfully not turning that pure white.
No, it's actually doing amazing things to your hair. I kind of really like that. The lighting designer in me sees all of these things.
Yeah, it could be some special effect to indicate that I was the hero in some film or a halo or something.
Exactly. My special guest this week is, for those of you who know me and who have heard some of my stories here on Every Woman and on The 10th Voice, know that I've had kind of a varied career in the entertainment industry. And one of the things I've done is I've done some concert touring. And I met our guest about 3.5 years ago or something on a tour. And she is, from the moment I met her, I was just enamored with her. She is amazing. She always made me feel like someone had my back on the road and that I wasn't alone and that everything was just going to be taken care of. She has been a concert and tour manager and coordinator of for over 20 years. She's also a founding member of the Women in Touring Summit, where she is a vocal advocate for change in the touring industry on behalf of 1,800 members of that group. She is also heavily involved with mental health and substance abuse professionals on a weekly webinar called I'm With The Crew. And if that isn't enough, she also hosts the podcast Tales From Seat 4A, where she interviews many folks in the industry. And she is also one of the hosts of the daily pop culture podcast called Misty and Ike. So please welcome via Zoom from Los Angeles, Misty Roberts. Hi, Misty.
Hi, Rachel.
Thank you so much for joining us. I see you're in your podcast studio. I see your little logo behind your head, and
I am absolutely. It's a bit quieter here than in my neighborhood, so I figured I would just come over here for the day.
Yeah, that's very good. I'm a little jealous. You look very posh there, so I kind of love it.
We definitely have taken this time this year to make it as comfortable as we possibly can in here because we have spent a lot of time here together.
That's fantastic. So tell me, I'm always interested in folks' origin stories. And, you know, your career is not only prolific and long, but also you do something really unusual on your day to day when there isn't a pandemic. I was wondering if you could sort of fill in the blanks for me and tell me how you got sort of from there to here.
Yeah, I went to college for a couple of years and decided that just really was not for me and started working in a corporate job.
So you grew up in Kansas though, right?
I did. I grew up in a very, very small town called Richmond, Kansas, which is about 35, 40 minutes from Lawrence.
Gotcha.
After working in corporate world for a while, I kind of was like, part of my job was traveling, and I really, really enjoyed the traveling part, but not so much the actual job part.
So I know that feeling.
I met a couple of guys in Kansas City that were in a band and became very good friends, and they were asked to go and do a showcase in New York City, and they said, hey, do you want to come along with us? And I was like, you know, that sounds like fun. I love the travel part of what I do.
And how old were you when that that happened for you?
I was in my early 20s.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
A great time to do that sort of thing.
I worked with them for a couple of years, and then their band broke up. And I kind of had that, okay, do I go back to working in a corporate environment, or do I try and figure out how to do this? And I had met a couple of other bands through them and just got incredibly, incredibly lucky. You know, some other people asked me to go on the road with them, and I spent the first almost 8 years of my career in the industry doing, you know, small theaters, clubs, and traveling in a van and trailer.
Oh, boy.
Sleeping on every floor across America that someone would offer us. And I was pretty lucky about, I don't know, like I said, a little over 8 years into my career. I ended up with a band that had a pretty good opening slot on a bigger tour. And I met a couple of people on that tour and ended up on my first bus tour shortly after that.
That's fantastic. So what did you do with that early band when you went to New York? What sort of things were you doing for them?
Well, this was pre, you know, everyone having a smartphone and the internet and, right. You know, all of that. So it was a lot of going to the public library and printing off math directions. I did a lot of, like, you know, keeping receipts, accounting, things like that, selling merchandise. As it progressed, I started being the person that would call, you know, promoters ahead of time and do the small, short advances for a club tour. And I don't know, I think the way that I looked at it, I just took that time out there to really try to learn a little bit of everything. You know, I would help load in, I would help load out, I would go up on stage when they were setting up instruments and be in the way and be like, what does that do? What does that do? How does that work? What's that for?
Nice.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of soak up everything because at that point I wasn't really sure exactly what role I wanted to have, you know, out in the music industry. I wasn't sure what role was out there for me, sure. Not being a musician.
Right, right. So you mentioned you were in the corporate world. What sort of things were you doing in the corporate world, and did that help prepare you to do this sort of thing, or?
No.
Not at all.
I worked for a telecommunications company that would send me out to some of their, like, call centers and things like that, and I would go in and I would assess the management in that center and go out and actually, like, talk to the employees and figure out what was working and what wasn't working, and then come back and suggest to them changes that they could make in their management. I compare it a lot to motivational speaking.
Sure.
Because I, you know, I would stand up in front of the groups of employees at the end of it and, you know, try and give them these motivational speeches, because typically call centers are not a happy environment.
No.
You know, I mean, think about any time you've ever had to call your phone company.
Yes.
Think of a room full of those people getting yelled at. So, I mean, there was a great interest in trying to figure out how to retain employees in places like that.
Yeah.
So that was part of my role, was trying to figure out, you know, help their managers figure out how to manage people and motivate them and keep them as employees for longer than, you know, to do away with the turnover rate that they had.
It sounds like, though, some of those skills would be very useful because, you know, you're constantly often dealing with big egos and trying to make the peace between people. So it seems like a little bit of that could, you know, spill over.
I kind of feel like that's something that I've kind of done my whole life. I've been the peacemaker and the tried to kind of be like the calm voice in things. So I don't necessarily feel like it started there, but I definitely was able to hone it with people that were not in my normal environment there.
Sure. So you're with this band, and then you apparently liked the experience. You liked the travel and the environment and stuff. And so then they broke up, and then did you go back to Kansas again? Or how did you then jump to the next thing?
Well, they were always in Kansas. They were in Kansas City. And so I hadn't ever really, I mean, we would travel like Thursday through Sunday and go and do shows like throughout the Midwest. And I mean, in that, we met a lot of other bands in the Midwest.
Sure.
You know, we would strike deals. You open for us here. We'll open for you there. You know, bring your audience to us. So I guess I made a lot of good contacts, and you know, very shortly after the Kansas City band broke up, I got an offer to work for a band from Oklahoma, and I toured with them for a while. And then it was a band from Seattle, and then a band from Boston. And when I was with the band from Boston, their name was Damon. We opened for a college tour with the All-American Rejects. And that's where I kind of made, where I first kind of really got an idea that there were actual crews of people that traveled with these bigger bands.
Right.
Not just one person.
Not just the band.
And I got to see that there were other roles that bigger groups had.
Yeah. So what do you think was your, you said then you sort of made your transition to your first bus tour. How did that first big break kind of happen for you?
Friend of a friend. You know, I often tell people in this industry that a lot of it is based on who you know. You know, it's,
yes.
I live in Los Angeles, which is an entire city full of who you know. I work in an industry that's full of who you know. When we were out with the All-American Rejects, they had a tour accountant out with them. His name is Bob Davis. And it's kind of a funny story. One day he walked out, because they all had offices in the back by the dressing rooms, and he walked out of his office, and I was sitting on the floor in the middle of the hallway with all of these receipts right out in front of me, trying to do accounting, because we only had one dressing room, and the band was in it. And he was like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Accounting." And he's like, "That is not accounting." Pick that stuff up, come into my office, sit with me, and let me show you how to do that properly. And he kind of took me under his wing. And after that tour was over, a few months later, he had sent me that someone was looking for someone to come out on this tour as a production assistant. And at the time, I had no idea what that meant. but he sent me the contact, and I sent the person my resume, and I listed Bob as one of my references.
Yes.
And when she called, she had already called Bob to say, "Who is this person? You know, do you think she'd be a good fit?" And he, of course, had said, "Absolutely." And that was my first bus tour. It was with Mannheim Steamroller, the Christmas Orchestra.
Oh, my. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
You must have felt like you'd hit the big time at that point. So no longer driving in the vans.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely. I was like, wow, this is what it's all about. Somebody drives instead of me? What?
Right. It's got a little couch. I've got a driver. It's fantastic.
Yeah. We got fed.
I know, right?
I didn't even understand that. I was like, what do you mean that I don't have to go find my own food? I don't, what? There's catering. What is that?
That is amazing. Okay. We have already come up to our first break. So we are just going to take a brief station break, and we will be back with more with Misty Roberts. And welcome back to the Every Woman Show. I am Rachel, and I am speaking with Misty Roberts, who is joining us via Zoom from Los Angeles. So when last we were speaking, we were talking about your sort of first big bus tour. You were with, and what was your position with Mannheim Steamroller? It was production assistant?
Production assistant. Yeah.
Got you. And so what does a production assistant do in that case?
Well, I had to learn all of that.
Right.
I had no idea.
Right.
I definitely very quickly realized that all the skills that I had learned, you know, being a tour manager on smaller tours came in very, very handy. I was responsible for doing the advancing for things like catering, you know, planning out the venues will send you, you know, a list of, hey, here's, because we weren't carrying our own catering with us. Here's all the meal suggestions, pick out what you want for, you know, the three meals that day. I was in charge of handling all of the runners in each city. We have a couple of people that come in and have access to vehicles and can go out and do things like fill subscription or prescriptions for people, you know, if they need medication refilled, or take, dry cleaning, you know. Mannheim Steamroller has, you know, they had wardrobe that they actually wore on stage. They had suits and things like that. So we would need to get those dry cleaned. And I mean, basically the way that I've always like described it to people is any access to the outside world, I was your go-to person.
Right.
Because when you're, you know, when you're parked at a venue all day, you're working all day and you don't really, I mean, even the musicians have to come in at, you know, on a tour like that. We started earlier because we had local orchestras that played with us and they had to do a run through of the entire show.
Oh boy.
To make sure that the local orchestra knew everything properly.
Sure.
So, you know, nobody can really just run out and go and do an errand. And I mean, it's a lot easier these days with things like Uber, you know, and
right.
Uber Eats and Postmates and, you know, all of that stuff. But back then it was a whole lot more of, hey, I need toothpaste, Misty. I ran out of toothpaste yesterday. Okay, hold on. Let me go send the runner out. What kind do you want? You know, things like that.
Yeah,
and people don't realize it's literally just it really is a moving city. You know, yeah. we have this little group or big group depending upon the size of the tour, and we move from city to city. And you don't know, you know, you wake up in the bus and you don't know where you're at. You don't know where the coffee shop is at.
Right.
You don't know things like that. So you rely on a lot of really great local people to help you out with stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds trivial. It's like, Misty, I ran out of toothpaste. But when you're in on that crew and working, all of that means everything to you because there is
absolutely
literally no time. You can't leave the venue. And like you said, most of the time, you don't really have a sense of where you are necessarily. You know you're in the venue, but you're not really sure where that venue is in relation to the city. And if you're going to, if you're playing one nights, you don't really get to see any of the city. You get to see the venue and the bus.
Yeah. And it's kind of a toss up too, because the way that most cities have built their arenas, it's about 50-50. Like half of them are right in the middle of the city and the other half are in the suburbs.
Right. Right.
So, you know, you may walk out of the bus and be like, I'm in Detroit, except I'm nowhere near Detroit.
Right.
I'm actually 30 miles outside of Detroit at an arena in the middle of nowhere.
Yes.
You know, a lot of cities have done that just because of their, you know, the ability of people to take public transportation to get to them. And, you know, it's easier to not take up all of that land in the middle of the city.
Sure.
Cheaper also to build an arena outside of the city.
No, that's very true. That's very true. And a lot of cities, you know, want that too, to help, you know, to spread the population out. And in older cities, it's hard to, you know, just sort of like Kansas City did, they just sort of leveled a whole bunch of old hotels and things and dropped an arena right in the middle of the city, which is actually pretty great, but unusual.
It was pretty great because that area was not so great beforehand.
No, not at all.
But I grew up in Birmingham, England, and theirs is like two train stops outside of the city center, and a huge conference center, and you can have exhibitions and everything. And the cost to have done that in the center of the city would have been astronomical.
Absolutely. And it's one of my favorite places in the UK to play is the Birmingham one, because it is outside of the city. And if you have a day off, you take the train into the city. It's just super relaxing to me.
Yeah, it has its own station on the train line. And they built that. It's really cool.
I felt like a champion when I figured that out. I was like, I can travel anywhere. I can take public transportation.
England, no less. So you were a production assistant now. And so how did you then move up to becoming the tour manager and coordinator? How did that work out? Or how did it happen?
Well, I mean, you basically start out on a tour, you know, if you're in the office environment as a production assistant, you know, just to learn the inner workings of everything.
Sure.
And I took a pretty great interest really early on. I think, like I said earlier about, you know, when I was out with Van and Trailer Bands, like, find extra time going and saying, what's that thing do? And I did a lot of that, you know, as a production assistant, you know, I would get my stuff done and then go and like, okay, so you're the rigger. What does that mean?
Right.
I don't, like, what do you do?
And you have to get here so early.
You know, because I literally was the only person traveling, you know, for 8 years with a band before that.
Right.
And so all of these positions were so new and weird to me. I didn't know any of it. I didn't come from any kind of a theater background. I can't play music. I'm tone deaf. I can't sing. So, you know, I had to go in and, like, learn who all these people were. And I got hired onto a bigger tour, and the production manager said, okay, we're going to have a production assistant and a production coordinator. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what's the difference? And he's like, well, basically the production coordinator is going to be the person who's kind of looking forward to upcoming cities and getting everything in advance. The production assistant will be doing the day-to-day stuff here in the office. And I was like, well, I want to know how to do that. So can I be the coordinator? And I ended up being the coordinator.
Fantastic.
And through that, I think, like, when you're in a position where you are the one looking it towards the future and in advance,
yes,
you start to take on a lot of those same characteristics as tour managers and road managers do, because sure, that's road managers are living in the future. Right. You know, tour right. managers, they're literally sitting down, you know, a month, 2 months before a tour starts, figuring out all of the hotels for the entire tour, you know, the routing. You're perpetually 3 days ahead of yourself.
Right.
So I started to work a little bit more closely with, like, the actual band themselves, mm-hmm. and not always, I mean, I would work with the crew, but the production assistant primarily dealt with the stuff for the crew.
Right.
And I would start helping out dealing with the band, which you probably saw a lot of on the tour that we did together. There was a large band.
Yes.
And
yes.
they were very, trying to think of a good way to put this. They liked to party. They liked yes. to have a good time.
True.
And they didn't have, you know, the tour manager was very involved with the artist side of things. And so the band didn't really have anybody to, like, rein them in and kind of make sure that they were at places on time. And
yes.
so I kind of just took it upon myself to do that. And, you know, I feel like it's just like, you know, a job in any kind of a corporate environment, you just kind of start to learn other things about other roles, and just, you either stay doing what you're doing or you do more.
Right.
Or you and can. I've always been that person that wants to do more.
Yeah. I think that's amazing. It's a story I've heard many times, especially in the entertainment industry. Two things. One, you sort of get jobs from the people you know, and you get them from your friends or folks that are doing your job for someone else. And this concept of sort of fake it till you make it. It's like, yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah.
Now what do I do?
Yep.
And, you know, you Absolutely. Just kind of do it. I mean, one of my biggest breaks happened that way, where I was sent to Canada as an expert programmer, and I had like 3 days of experience with this system, and I was like, here we go.
I think that it requires a certain amount of fearlessness to be able to do that.
Yes.
You know, like, I think that not knowing any better, I got thrown into situations and just kind of, like, said, okay, I'll figure it out. And right. then that lent itself to people going, she'll figure it out, just let her do it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it is that fearlessness and going, well, you know what? I would rather try it and fail than say no completely.
Right.
And I think I have a lot of that. Like, I have failed at things, sure. and I'm not scared to fail at things. I'm not scared to say I messed up.
Yeah.
I didn't do that right. I didn't learn things from it.
Yeah, that's a really important lesson to learn, actually. And in your industry, that is, you know, mostly a male-dominated industry, that must be really hard as a woman to be able to say, yep, I screwed up.
It's, yes.
Yes.
The expectation is much, much higher.
Yeah.
It definitely, I mean, it's starting to look a lot different nowadays, mm-hmm. but when I first started doing this, I would be the only woman on a tour. You know, I would be one of maybe four or five on a tour of 100.
Right.
And it's almost like going into it, it's expected that because you're a woman, you're going to mess it up.
That's awful.
But yet you're not given the grace when you do.
Right.
So it's, It's an interesting thing. And I've spent hours and hours of my life sitting back trying to like figure it out and think about it and analyze it. And I don't think that there's anything that I can say that is going to say anything new about what it's like being a woman in a male-dominated industry. I think that the last few years have brought a lot of it to light. And I think the one difference that we do have out in the touring world is that there is no HR department. Right. There is no path to how to deal with something happening out on the road that's not appropriate.
Right.
And there's also, you know, you have a very interesting mixture of a lot of very, very old school mindsets and that clashing with a very new school mindset, which definitely think can probably be applied across the board these days.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you have a lot of those older roadies that, you know, love to sit around and tell stories of, oh, remember when we were on tour with the crew, Motley Crue back in 82? And you're like, I don't care because it's not 1982 anymore.
Exactly.
So just because you got away with that then doesn't mean that it's acceptable now. Yeah. You know, this is no longer one of those fringe careers. I've been on tour with people that have multiple degrees in engineering. Mm-hmm. You know, we're taking a mobile city from place to place every day and building a skyscraper.
Absolutely.
Essentially.
Yes.
It's the skill levels have changed. What's required of you has changed. So the mindset should be changing as well.
No, I agree. It's amazing. I mean, there's such an amazing cross-section, and especially now with the technology that's involved in some of these concerts, you have people who are highly specialized that just, you know,
really.
I've been on tours where there was people who all they did was network integration just to get all of the various bits to talk to each other. And, you know, that's like a total corporate gig to have, is to, you know, make computers talk to each other. But it was mission critical. And, you know, not the typical roadie that you would think of.
No, people have this image of roadies from, you know, like I said, like the 80s,
right,
where it was some guy that they picked up off the, you know, loading dock of an arena because he had the good drug,
right,
and brought on tour with him. And it doesn't look like that anymore. It really doesn't. You know, people, you're right. The advances in technology and the things that are required, people want experts to do those things because health and safety is at risk.
Yes.
You don't want the guy who's going to come to work still drunk from the night before.
No.
Like, that doesn't work anymore.
No, it doesn't. It's amazing, too. There's such a cross-section because there are still folks, you know, sort of old school, old guard people, younger people.
Oh, yeah.
And my experience has been, it's almost like a microcosm of the schoolyard because, you know, people break off into cliques. And if you don't fit in one of these cliques, you're ostracized from that. And, you know, that's really detrimental to your mental health and to trying to do your job.
Very much. Well, and I can tell you, too, like, I mean, mental health is something that I've struggled with pretty much my entire life. But amplifying it, being out on the road, first of all, you have no sense of stability. There isn't a place to call home other than your bunk. And your bunk moves.
Right.
And also, your bunk has somebody that maybe you got into a screaming match with earlier in the day sleeping 3 feet above you.
Right.
There is no escape, which is why I think a lot of people get into a lot of trouble and have a lot of problems on their day off, because that's the escape day.
Yes.
To get away from whatever. But also, when you have someone like me who kind of has to be the no to everything, you know, I'm the person that sits in the office and says, no, I'm not going to get you that for after show food tonight. No, I don't have time to send the runner to go and get you a bottle of Jack today.
Right.
No, the runner didn't have time to stop and pick up your cigarettes. I'm sorry. You know, and part of my role is prioritizing things.
Right.
And people don't deal well at all realizing that they're maybe not the number one priority.
Yes. Yeah, it's...
So, I mean, you're right. It is a microcosm of the playground, and you do have those cliques. And then you have someone like me who's the mean mom, and you don't get those calls on days off. Like, hey, do you want to go have dinner?
Right.
Nobody wants to talk to you. You know, everybody wants to hang out with their clique. They don't want to talk to you because you're the one who's going to tell them their call time for the morning, which is an hour earlier because you have to drive to the venue. You know, like, oh, she's the one that she made me wait for my hotel room because it wasn't ready this morning. I didn't get to my room in time for whatever.
Right.
So there's also very much a level of isolation to being one of those people that people look to all the time because you can't always make them happy.
Right.
You're not ever going to make everyone happy, but you're gonna make more of them unhappy than you're probably going to make happy. You know, the things that you do to make them happy are not things that they'll ever acknowledge. Right. The fact that they had a hotel room in the first place.
Right.
The fact that they had after-show food to eat when they were starving after a two-hour loadout. They don't think about those things. They just think about the things you told them no to.
No, that's very true. And how, so, I mean, you strike me as a person who definitely wants to make people happy. And, you know, and you're one of your main focuses in your job is to create an environment where people can be successful. And so how do you deal with it when you can't make everyone happy? How does that affect you?
I used to take it very, very, very much to heart. I used to take it on a very personal level. And I found myself in points of burnout and just sheer exhaustion from trying to not have to say no to someone.
Right.
You know, like bending over backwards and doing completely out of the ordinary things to make something happen for somebody else that in all actuality, I should have just said no.
Right. Right.
And, you know, it took me to a couple of points where, you know, I either would go home and not take a tour for a while because I was just so physically and emotionally exhausted.
Right.
Or I had a tour a few years ago. It's the only time I left the tour and went home because I was physically ill because of all of it. Wow. I went back to Seattle where I was living at the time and I went and saw, I can't even tell you how many doctors. I had every test under the sun.
Yes.
The diagnoses were ridiculous. First, it was lupus, because that's what they tell everyone that they have when something's wrong, they can't figure it out. Oh, you just have lupus. And then it was Legionnaire's disease.
What?
And then it was you have an infection in the lining of your heart. And it wow. literally would range from like, oh, you have really bad allergies to you might die tomorrow.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, I woke up one morning and I was like, okay, I'm swallowing literally a handful of pills. I don't know what, none of them are making a difference.
Right.
I still feel like crap all the time. And I went to go see a homeopathic doctor and he was like, first of all, he's like, your adrenal system is just completely shot. Like your
yeah.
sense of time and space and when your body rests and when it's awake. And he's like, you're just so completely like you have no sense of stability in your body at all.
Right.
Because of these, you know, 20 years of what you've been doing. But he's like, aside from that, has anybody asked you if you've seen a therapist at all? And I was like, no, what do you mean? And he's like, you sound like you have a very, very high pressure job and that you take a lot on yourself. He's like, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that these attacks that you're having aren't allergies. They're not anything. I think you're having anxiety attacks.
Right.
And I was like, that's not possible.
Right.
Because my mom suffered from anxiety attacks and I had seen what those looked like. And for my mom, it was very much like, I think I'm having a heart attack. And mine didn't display the same way.
Yeah.
And I remember telling him, I was like, that's not it. My mom has those. And that's not what it looks like. And he's like, anxiety manifests in everyone differently.
Exactly.
And I was like, what? okay.
Yeah.
And it still took me about another year, you know, before I went, okay, maybe there was a little truth to that, because I still don't feel great. Right. And still having these weird attacks where I can't breathe. And then I went into therapy pretty hardcore for about 3 years.
Yeah.
And my life changed.
That is fantastic. Yeah, it's a hard thing to wrap your head around, because especially in that environment, you are so isolated from the quote unquote real world, because, you know, like you said, you are a traveling city. You're making up your own times. You're sleeping in bizarre places at weird times. And there's this overall attitude of just, you know, you can't break down. You've got to do it. You've got to do it no matter what.
Right.
And
you don't want to be weak to anybody.
Right.
And, you know, I always make a joke, because there, you know, for people like you that were on my crew, I could walk by and maybe see, you know, one of the crew guys like curled up in a set cart taking a nap. Yes. And I would think, wow, that looks so nice to be able to take a nap in that hard cement set cart, metal set cart. Because in my role, they're like, from the minute you walk into the arena, which is normally around 6 a.m. because you're the first person in.
Yes.
Until 2 o'clock in the morning at the end of loadout, you're working.
Yes.
There is no downtime. There is no, I'm going to go take a nap real quick because my job's done for the day until showtime.
Right.
We don't have that. And I remember doing exactly that, like walking by someone that was asleep on a set cart and just looking at them and being like, so jealous. And I was like, stop. Like, this isn't humane.
Right.
And I started to set a lot of boundaries for myself. I started, when I would, you know, interview with people, I'd be like, I'm not sitting in the office until 2 o'clock in the morning when the last person walks out. I'm not doing it.
Right.
Like, there is no reason for it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, we have 6 security guards out there. Why am I the one here in the office protecting people's backpacks during loadout?
Right.
Yes. Why don't you leave it on your bus and go get it before you go take your shower when you're done loading up? Why make someone else suffer?
Right.
Because you're lazy. I really started like trying to stand up for myself and be like, you know, I know that the girl in the office used to be the girl in the office and no one cared.
Yes.
Well, it's time to start caring.
Yes. No, that is a good point. So tell me about the Women in Touring Summit that you were a founder of, and the genesis of that, and what's involved with that.
Yeah. So out on tour, there's a production manager. Mostly that is dominated by males. Then there's a production coordinator and a production assistant. And outside of that, you really don't have any other women.
Yes.
You know, you may have the occasional tech, but they're out on the floor working all day. So you don't get to build those same relationships. And about the time that I started to realize how stressed out that I was, I realized that it would be really, really helpful if I had a group of people to talk to that understood it. And because the role is very solitary, there is only one of you on tour. So I started a Facebook group and invited, you know, people that I had been up against, you know, to get jobs. I've been like, okay, let me invite this group of people that do the same thing that I do so that maybe we can share experiences, because I can't be the only one feeling like this.
Right.
I can't be the only one that's frustrated with this one question every day that's the same, or, you know, how do I handle talking to that guy with that specific personality defect or whatever. And so I started a group, and just basically out of my own need to communicate with people that would understand. And it grew and it grew and it grew. And right now, I think it has around 1,800 people in it.
Wow.
2 years ago, we partnered with a roadie convention that was already in existence called Tour Link. Okay. And it was a once-a-year thing that people would go to. The year we did it was in Arizona. All the vendors would bring out all of their like flashy new, you know, here's the latest and greatest in lighting, beep boop bops and whatever. And, you know, all the transportation companies, they would show off their new fancy, you know, this is our brand new private, you know, plane. Right. And here's our upgraded bus.
Yes.
And so they were able to give us the day before the convention, since a lot of people would be there already. And we had about 200 women mm-hmm. that registered to come to it. And we had panels that that we set up all day long that just really tackled women's issues out on the road.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as much as it's great for a man to be like, oh, if you want to be treated the same, then you shouldn't have to have a group of just women. Yes. And I'm like, it doesn't really work that way. Like, there exactly. are things that only affect women.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, as simple as being having your time of the month out on the road.
Right.
Like, it's going to happen. We're out on the road for 4 months at a time. That's four periods that are going to happen no matter what, you know? Like,
right.
things like that, like, that men just don't necessarily always take into account. It's just, oh, she's in a mood today.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm miserable. Like, I'm physically miserable. I'm in this cold, drafty office back here. I can't get comfortable no matter what I do. I can't just go to the bus and take a nap because that doesn't work. Like,
right.
you know, how do you, like, we sat and we talked about things like as simple as that, but then we got into things as complicated as sexual abuse out on the road.
Sure.
Sexual assault
sure.
out on the road. You know, we had, we kind of put that as the last thing of the day because we knew it was going to be a very heavy conversation, sexual harassment out on the road
mm-hmm.
because we don't have an HR department.
Right.
And you know, we live in an environment that the victim is to blame somehow, some way. You know, where do you go? What's the process if something like that happens? You know, is it the tour manager? Is it the production manager? Is it management? Where does that happen? And we had a lot of women stand up and tell their stories, which is probably one of the most amazing moments of my life. Heartbreaking and heart uplifting at the same time to hear the stories, but to also know that we created a space that we could share those stories with each other
right.
was really, really powerful. We decided last year not to partner with anyone. We felt like there was kind of a mad rush of a bunch of men with all these conventions that wanted to glom on and say, we got the ladies. So we decided to just do it on our own.
Nice.
We held it here in LA at the W Hotel, and we just did it on our own without any of that.
Cool.
So this year, obviously, things look a little different. So the ladies group has actually been doing Zoom calls every Tuesday and Saturday as just an open house the entire year. So I think the conversations that would happen at the Women's Summit this year have been happening on a weekly basis.
That's fantastic. We need to take a short break. And so stay tuned, please. And we will be right back with more conversation with Misty Roberts right after this. And we are back with the Every Woman Show. I am Rachel. I'm joined on Zoom by my co-host Fiona, and we are speaking with Misty Roberts, also via Zoom from Los Angeles. I know that one of the things that you were talking about is just being able for women to sort of congregate and have a place to go just to be with other women sometimes is incredibly valuable because, you know, the men dominate the women in terms of sheer numbers on a crew and, you know, they get, you know, boys time all day long. And the number of women on the crew on the crew that I was on was just a handful. And so just having a space to even just go and not be around guys for a while can be so valuable to your mental health.
Well, people don't realize, you know, that there is an inherent energy that's brought into a room with a male or female.
Yes.
And it's not something that we need to look poorly upon. It's not saying that every man that walks in a room is going to bring toxic masculinity.
Sure.
You know, in our field, there is a lot of toxic masculinity that comes along with it. But it's one of the things that I've definitely realized this year. you know, being locked down, quarantined, whatever you want to call it, I've spent a lot of time here in the studio with my male counterpart, mm-hmm. and I haven't been able to have, you know, to be able to see in person those very, very close, dear friends of mine. You know, my best friend is in Kansas City still.
Right.
And, you know, I have friends all over the place, Boston, Miami, Chicago, and I'm not able to travel. And I miss being able to be around that female energy.
Yes.
That there's just something very comforting about it. You know, my one of my closest friends in Chicago and I, she's like, it's really weird because when we get together, we don't ever do anything crazy. You know, we used to when we were young, but right. she's like, I just miss being with you.
Yes.
Like, just simply being. And I just really hadn't thought about that. And it's an interesting thing that I think we can learn a lot about, you know, if we take some of the things that have happened this year.
No, I couldn't agree more. It's you know, because the dynamic is always different when there's a mixed group of folks, especially when you're working in such close quarters, like you're saying, and, you know, on yeah. tour, there's no privacy. The only privacy you have is your tiny little, your little bunk, and that's it. And that's just, you know, a little curtain that's pulled, and that's...
It's a fabric curtain.
Right.
Like, that's privacy. Like I said, you may have, you know, there are three bunks to each side. You may have somebody sleeping underneath you that smells bad and that you don't associate with regularly. And then you may have a guy sleeping 3 feet above you that you've gotten a screaming match with right. earlier in the day. Right. You know, it's like going to bed with a partner being angry. It's the same thing. You know, you still have, you can like palpably feel that energy, even right. with that little fabric curtain blocking you off from the world.
That is very true. So tell me about some of the other things that you've done during the pandemic, because the pandemic has pretty much decimated and shut down our industry completely.
It has. I'm a person of action. Like, when something's wrong, it takes me about 10 minutes to go, okay, what do I need to do to fix this? And so when the pandemic started, I instantly launched into throwing myself into anything that I could do to help all of the people in my industry. Like I said earlier, I am a very, very firm believer in therapy, mm-hmm. and I have a fantastic therapist that offered to host and be a guest on some webinars about mental health and how to navigate, especially for people that are traditionally nomadic.
Yes.
You know, that do wake up in a different city every day. How do you deal with waking up in the same place for a year?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, most of us in this industry have been in it for a long time. And there are an immense set of feelings that come along with that. And that goes so far beyond the panic of the financial part of it. But, you know, we have a very unique way of life.
Yes.
It is not something that a lot of people understand. And it is not something that I feel like a lot of people on the road even understand themselves.
Right.
So we wanted to really put it out there, you know, like, give people practices and ways of, you know, dealing with the feelings that they were feeling, and make sure that everybody knew that it was completely normal. Like, everyone was going to go through it.
Right.
You know, there was no way of avoiding some kind of an emotional meltdown during this last year at some point or another.
Yeah.
We also brought along a substance abuse counselor, mm-hmm. because right now is a very slippery slope for a lot of people of sliding back into old habits.
Yes.
When you're left at home with nothing to do, what are you going to do?
Exactly. So we have about a minute left. Do you have any?
Oh, man.
I know, right?
That went by fast.
It does. It always does. Do you have any sort of final thoughts you'd like to sort of impart to our audience?
Well, I mean, I have my podcasts are the other thing that I worked on. Every day there is a podcast that's called Misty Night, and it's a completely pop culture related, fun take your mind off of everything in the world for 15 minutes. It's only 15 minutes long. You can find it on every podcast platform, and you can find it on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube under Misty and Ike.
So just do a search for Misty and Ike on any of those platforms and you can find it?
Absolutely. We are there.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Misty. And yes, this hour has
flown. This is so fun, Rachel.
This hour has just flown by. I hope you're open to coming back at some point in the future, because we barely scratched the surface of this amazing life.
It's always fun to catch up.
Absolutely. And thank you so much, Fiona, for joining us today via Zoom.
Thank you for having me. I've loved listening to the conversation.
Absolutely.
I miss Birmingham. I miss traveling, Fiona.
I know, I can tell. It's been amazing listening to you.
I've got some dear friends there in Birmingham.
All right.
It is so cool speaking to someone who knows my home city.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Every Woman. I'm Rachel, and I will be here next week. Coming up next is Urban Connections. Stay tuned.